This is fun! The FU Network!
This is Level With Her, a podcast of in-depth conversations with video game greats. I'm Leanna Kersner, and this episode's guest is Quest for Glory co-creator and the creative director of the upcoming Summer Days at Hero U, video game veteran, Lori Cole. Greetings, FU Network podcast listeners. It is I, Leanna Kersner, giving you the inaugural podcast of this sort. And I have a very, very special guest for you. I'm very, very excited. I have with me Lori Cole, who is one of the creators of Castle of Dr. Brain, Shannara Games, Mixed Up Fairy Tales, but you'll best know her from the beloved series Quest for Glory. Lori, you have a game series old enough to have been put through college and med school. What does that feel like?
It feels like I'm getting a little old here. Yes, I could be the grandmother for some of my players, I mean.
Now, that is a real distinction that you and your husband, Corey, share. Most of the people from the old classic Sierra days have moved on to other things or retired. You guys are still going. You guys are still innovating. We'll get to your upcoming game, Summer Days at Hero U, in a bit. But what's allowed you to stick with the business when so many people have gone on to other things?
Well, computer game business is a very stressful, intensive, overwhelming kind of thing. You have to have a strong personality and a lot of willpower to keep going on it, because it's never easy. But what's really kept us going is that our games reached and touched people, and it's because we got these strong fans that continued to support us and kept encouraging us to create that we're still in the business, basically.
Yeah. Now let's go back to before the beginning, because, you know, a game coming out in 1989. When did you actually start working on Quest for Glory?
I think it was just the year before, because Corey got the job at Sierra to become a computer programmer doing the Atari ST conversions. And so therefore it was up to me to actually, you know, propose our game.
Now, you say Atari ST conversions, people get a sense of what gaming was doing at the time. Were you a video game player or computer game player at the time, or was it mainly like tabletop role playing for you?
Well, we played some games. Our computers were pretty good at that time, but mostly we were frustrated with the computer games of that era, because we did play a lot of tabletop or RPGs, and that thrill and the pleasure of playing an RPG game was not to be found in a computer game. We wanted to give that, you know, that's what we wanted from a computer game.
That's something developers to this day struggle with. There has never been a truly successful, like, AAA conversion of that experience. Many have tried, many have died doing it, sometimes literally. What do you think is the elusive element of tabletop that you know, modern AAA big budget games don't get?
Well, it's that sense of wonder that you get, and the sense that you are a part of something special that makes a tabletop game feel so outstanding. When your character becomes does something right, you get that rush as if it were real. Now, because you so relate to that character.
Now, that character relation is something that people go back and forth on in video games a lot. You had the a character in Quest for Glory and Hero's Quest originally that was just called the hero, and yet so much personality was infused into that character, and the game referred to it as you all the time, even though you're looking at a character that didn't look like me, you know, blonde and male and all that stuff. And yet there was this sense of attachment through sort of the goofy, I don't totally know what I'm doing quality of the character. Is that what you meant by a sense of wonder?
Well, what we were trying to do with Quest for Glory is really make the player, that's their avatar in the game. We tried to give the character as little personality as possible because we wanted the player to project their personality and what they thought onto that character.
Now, that's a huge difference in writing and designing a video game than writing and designing a movie or a novel. That this is something that people come to blows with over gaming. The idea that the player needs a certain amount of control. The player needs to put themselves in the main character. Now, you guys, when you make your games, you create stories about specific people. It's not like a custom avatar where it's like male, female, pick your hair color, pick, you know, pick your race, all that stuff. It's a defined character that's gone straight through into Hero U and you know, Rogue to Redemption with Sean.
Well, we didn't start out that way because really what we wanted to do with the Quest for Glory series is really have you pick your own character and be, you know, male or female and be human or elf or centaur, but we couldn't get away with it at the time.
Was that because of technical limitations or marketing?
Technical, financial. It was just, you know, a huge, we had no clue how difficult that would have been.
Now,
pull off.
You guys made leaps and bounds in the adventure game. I'd almost claim that Heroes Quest / Quest for Glory started a whole new type of adventure / RPG game. There was sort of that, you saw the bridge to the other Quest games that Sierra was putting out, but you had that, you know, kind of grindy combat mechanic and the ability to plug in character points and pick your classes. Did you know how ambitious and transformative that was going to be when you started out? Or was it like, well, this is fun, let's try it?
It's more of a, this is fun, let's try it. We were trying to do a game that we would like to play. Mm-hmm. I mean, so we put in the elements that we could get away with, i.e., you know, having an immersive world and having it designed around the player's behavior rather than around what we wanted the player to do. So we had to think from the point of the player, what does the player want to do here and now? And then try to, as much as we could, given the limitations of everything that was, you know, there, let the player do what they wanted to do.
Now that's tough in a parser-based game because it has a dictionary of only so many understood words. How did you tackle that challenge?
Well, we tackled it, you know, badly because we really didn't know what we were doing at the time. We didn't realize just how limiting this medium was at the time when we were doing it. And so therefore, it was a good thing we had some really good programmers on that really covered the concepts of, you know, what a parser has to do, all of these synonyms and but even then, we guided the player to a vocabulary as best we could, giving them keywords in the course of sentences and giving them a grammar. So ask about became the grammar of the game.
Yeah, it's interesting you say it was so limiting because in some ways I find those old games, because I could type in anything I wanted, even though it was wrong, I felt a greater sense of attachment to it. I felt a greater sense of that was my character, that was my voice, than now we have, you know, the angry thing and the you know, charming thing and the, you know, the blue or green pick one thing that a lot of RPGs go with now. When you switch to point and click, you guys still manage to keep that sense of character in there. Do you have any insights about how you did that?
Well, it wasn't easy. I mean, the problem I have with parser-based games, and we have a lot of people, you know, it depends on when you started playing games. If you played in the parser era, that is the gold. Because that is, you know, closer to real D&D where you had control of your character and you could, you know, everything you thought of came from you. Mm-hmm. But when we got into the point and click era, we accommodated an easier gameplay that kept the player from being totally frustrated. Because the thing I hated about adventure games is when you knew what you wanted to do, you just couldn't find the words to make it do what you wanted it to do. And you're fighting the game, you're fighting the interface, and you're not playing the game.
Now, that's what we would call now ludonarrative dissonance. But fighting the interface is actually probably a better term for that design problem. The idea that a player wants to feel like they're doing one thing, the game is forcing them to do another. When you're designing puzzle-based games, and Quest for Glory had a lot of puzzles, even though it had combat as well, you need enough difficulty that people feel a sense of accomplishment in, you know, beating the puzzle or solving the puzzle or beating the enemy, but not so much difficulty or not the wrong kind of difficulty so that they just get frustrated and give up. So how do you personally approach that challenge?
Well, it really is important. One of our, our unwritten rules of game design, one of them is the player must be challenged and they must feel like the thing they're facing is tough and that they need to figure it out and they need to be smart enough to do it. And then when they accomplish it, then there's that rush of, you know, that feeling and sense that you've achieved something, which is, you know, critical to making a game, you know, feel like it's worthwhile, worth playing. So it's always been an important thing. And I'll tell you, trying to switch from a parser game to the point and click thing initially was tough because, you know, there's a lot of parser game play that is much more challenging, you know. And so once you get into the point and click, you've removed a lot of ability for the game as a game designer to get that sense out of the blue, the player figured this out, because you're giving away an awful lot with your point and click thing.
So you have to find a way to make the game feel less like it's on rails.
Yes.
Yeah.
And more like you're giving the player choices that are meaningful. So all of our games, you know, they have a state where you could lose the game or you could make a mistake and get into serious trouble because the player has to have that ability to do something, whether it's right or wrong.
See, that was what distinguished the Sierra games back in the day from the LucasArts games, is that, you know, you couldn't die in a LucasArts game. You just kind of farted around. You got different endings, but the Sierra deaths were a huge part of the experience. You had those sort of fast pass-fail conditions. Some of them were hilarious. Like my favorite one was if you know, your lock-picking skill is very low and you type in pick nose, you get a very hilarious, you know, death script there. What went into planning when those hard fails were going to happen?
Well, first of all, I had a debate a long time ago at a computer gaming conference with Ron Gilbert, who had done Monkey Island. And his argument was that any death takes you out of the game and it removes the immersion. And he had this wonderful anecdote about his girlfriend who was playing a game. And the first time she died, she didn't want to play that game again. She had lost. It was over. She didn't want to see it. And she'd lost all immersion or any sense that she was part of that game and didn't want to do it again. And I relate to that. I don't like, you know, making a mistake. But the advantage of games is that the only, you know, you can make a mistake, but then you can go back and fix it. That's what save games are for.
Right.
You never have to lose a game as long as you're willing to come back and stick to it. And so the trick is not to make the deaths meaningless and stupid. You know, like, oh, I misclicked here and I fell off the cliff.
Mm-hmm.
That's what, you know, Monkey Island made fun of. And yeah, I agree. That's not the right way to kill off a player. If you're going to kill off a player, do it because they honestly took too many chances and they made a mistake and they didn't come prepared when they actually realize why they died. Or, you know, kicking a cat. I mean, everybody knows that's a stupid thing to do. And we give the player a chance to do something stupid because the charm of a Leisure Suit Larry game, if there was any charm, mm-hmm. was how you died. And because the clever ways in which they handled the deaths, because it was as much a part of the game as anything else. Dying was, you know, intrinsic to the game, really, to have any fun.
Yeah, that sense that you could fail made the successes mm-hmm. mean more.
And so with our games, we wanted the player to feel like they had, you know, the control over whether their character would live or die. And so we gave them full feedback whenever it was dangerous, whenever their health was getting low, mm-hmm. so that they could, you know, find a way to deal with that as part of the puzzle.
Well, yeah. And I mean, with certain classes in Quest for Glory, like, you know, I play the rogue class a lot. You have to run away a lot in the early levels. And I think that was something that the player almost had to be trained to do because it was so unlike that arcade combat that you got, you know, when you used a coin-op machine. God, we're going back a ways here, that you just, you know, just press. You were this super powerful, you know, spaceship or tank or fighter or whatever. There was no sense of, you know, discretion is the better part of valor.
Well, the first time they played Heroes Quest, they couldn't believe that one of the characters lied to them. I mean, they were so used to everybody in a game being cardboard characters that were there to promote the rest of the game. And when that character lied to them, it was like, wait, he can't do that, can he?
That was the reaction initially, that they were so unused to computer game characters being people. Even in the, you know, environment of Sierra Adventure Games, that was a surprise to them?
We got it from several people that were just shocked. But I think because they were just games to them at that point, and the games treated characters as games, as just pieces on the board. They weren't humans. They weren't people. And for me, when I write anything, you know, every character in the game, from the shopkeeper to the, you know, the guard on the wall, is a real personality and had meaningful background story and meaningful dialogue. So therefore they didn't, you know, you would get misinformation or you'd get lies, because that's what people do.
Now that's that tabletop role-playing influence coming out, because when people label something an RPG, this is something that frustrates me. It tends to be, oh, you get skill points and choices of loot, and you get to pick what class your character is. The actual role-playing element of the in-game interactions tends to be fairly weak. In the Quest for Glory games, even with the limitations you had, it very much wasn't. You could choose who you liked, who you didn't like, who you sided with, how you solved a problem. How do you feel about the way role-playing games, especially adventure role-playing games, have sort of nestled into computer gaming in that way? Is there stuff you'd like to see be done better?
Well, there always is, but then I try to do, you know, generally when I make a game, I try to figure out what I like best in the games that are going out around then and try to do it better. You know, that's just it. It's, you know, we're all trying to learn from the mistakes of the past and also from the good things of the past and make them even better.
Now, what do you play?
Oh, well, I play World of Warcraft.
There you go.
But I do play a lot of other, well, the kinds of games that I, you know, am doing games about, like the more dating sim style game that I'm doing now. I've played some of the games that are out there, every one that was recommended on there, and then I've watched a lot of Let's Play, so I let somebody else do it so I could see what's going on and see how they play. So I do my research to try to keep up with what's going on.
Now that separates you from a lot of, I mean, you're a creative director, you're not just a writer, but with Transolar Games, but that separates you from some fairly high profile writers that are like, oh, I don't have time. I'm far too busy to play games. You yourself are a gamer.
When we went to Sierra Online the first time, and we tried to, you know, find a group to play games, there weren't that many people at Sierra who actually played games. And that is true. You know, everybody thinks they can make a game, but not everybody really likes and plays games. And it's a, you know, what's the point of being at a game company if you don't enjoy playing games?
I think a lot of gamers would agree with you there. And I think this is what I like about your design compared to, you know, a lot of people in the indie space who have a story they want to tell. And so they create this interactive experience to tell this story they feel very, very strongly about. And there's all this exposition and that on-rails phenomenon. That seems to be what's rewarded in the indie space. What you do is like you said, you sort of create this environment. It's not just a sandbox, because it's a sandbox with all these toys you give the player to play, and then like guidance along the way of what to do with those toys. Do you think it's just everybody's different, or do you think there are actual camps in terms of design, in terms of people that start with the story and then make the game, and then people who make the game and then figure out what the story is going to be for that game?
Well, you know, that goes back to tabletop role-playing games, mm-hmm. because I know an awful lot of game masters who simply are there to tell the story, and the players get in the way of the story, you know? So they keep trying to push the story back into place by getting yeah. those players. It's so frustrating mm-hmm. when you're playing in that situation, because then your character isn't really tell part of the story. It's just the pawn on the board again. And that's true of many different people who do it, and many different computer games too, because it comes down to the personality of the designer and whether he thinks he's telling the story for the players or whether she thinks mm-hmm. that the players are telling the story, and they have to pull the pieces out of the environment that's around them to create the story that they believe in.
Do you think there is a level? I noticed you went he and then she there.
Only because that's me. Right. You know, I'm yeah. that way. Yeah, yeah. I shifted off just because, you know, that's the way I GM as a game master, because I do still occasionally play tabletop games. Mm-hmm. And it's how I think the game should be. An improvisation on the part of the players with the GM.
Yeah, I used to prepare very heavily for D&D, and then I realized this is a waste of my time because the players never do what I'm going to expect. And, you know, then you get into experiences like Ravenloft, where it is sort of a cooperative experience, because, you know, you can re-roll and everything's in a different place. And the Dungeon Master, or in White Wolf, the Storyteller, and the party members, the players, are on the same team.
Yes.
Is that sort of how you approach it?
Right. The GM and the game developer designer is not the enemy of the players, but he can be the opposition to the players. In the end, we want to have a satisfying story that all makes sense and all feels right when you get done. But the player in the course of that really has to feel like, you know, there was something exciting going on. Mm-hmm. There was something they had to do that really propelled the story forward. Otherwise, it's, again, you're in the passive, somebody telling you a story, and you're just, you know, being dragged along.
Now, this is interesting that you talk about excitement. You tend to undersell what's coming in the experience. You start with a very simple concept, and then the story blossoms. Like in the original Heroes Quest, it was, you know, the famous adventurer's correspondence school. People nowadays don't even know what a correspondence school is. It was sort of this tongue-in-cheek pop culture reference. But it was this person who basically did, like, now it would be an online course. to become a hero, and they think they knew it all, and they walk into Spielberg, and then you're confronted with like a guy on the porch and a monster guy, a goon with a yo-yo. And then you have to figure out what to do. Why do you start these stories with such humble beginnings?
I think because we all, if stories need a place to grow, and the player needs a chance to grow too. By starting it out with a character, and this is why I like role-playing, okay? Mm. Role-playing style games that have stats is because you could see how your character grows as the game progresses. You get that feeling that, you know, you're getting better. And it's all how you personally feel. It's not about this, you know, I'm just watching this character in the book that's, you know, going on. Mm-hmm. And so you identify with that character as they progress and as they get smarter or know more about the universe that they're in, because the player comes in with no knowledge of what's going to happen. So therefore, the character, you know, you don't want your player at odds with the character they're playing.
Now, since so many people are so very different, how do you create a character that a large number of people are not going to be at odds with?
And that's where you have to make the, you know, in the case of, you know, Quest for Glory, you make that character have very little obvious personality. You know, he doesn't say anything, because the minute you mm-hmm. say something, that voice will either be just what you thought you, how you thought it would be, or it'll be, wait a second, I didn't want to say that.
Right.
And there's nothing more frustrating. And I have played games before which, you know, gave you an option of what to say. And when you click on it, wait a second, that's yep. not what I meant.
Yep, that dialogue wheel system that Mass Effect uses. That's what drives me crazy about it.
Yes, and the one we were playing was Star Wars The Old Republic.
Same company, yeah, same system.
Yep, and it would be so no, don't say that. Now, that just breaks you from your game, yes.
Now, they went with that because their player base preferred it to, they wanted fully voiced, fully acted dialogue instead of what they had before, which was you clicked on exactly what you wanted to say, and then the other character responded to you. And this I find very strange, and I've never actually talked to anybody else who felt as passionately about it as you clearly do. That's, to me, movies slipping into games, that people want to see it acted out like you're playing with puppets or dolls. Whereas you seem to be at of the design school where, no, you want to believe you're interacting with these people. You don't want... you want as little avatar as possible getting in your way. Is that accurate?
That's pretty accurate. I mean, I did enjoy the Star Wars game. It was just when the lines that they gave the character were the, you know, diametrically opposed to what I wanted to say, because I couldn't tell the way they were doing it, what they were going to do. And there was some of that even back into the days of Monkey Island, where where they weren't giving the whole sentence you were going to say, and then you expected them to say something different. And so it's just a matter of, you know, again, user interface getting in the way of the gameplay.
For more with video game great Lori Cole, check out the next 3 episodes of the Level With Her podcast and become a monthly supporter of the FU Network's groundbreaking programming by going to patreon.com/FU Network TV.
This is fun! The FU Network!